Sarasata Sri Srimad Divine Grace Asi Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai. Prem Shri Kaho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopina Shaimakunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai, Mathura Dham Ki Jai. Navadvip Mayapur Dham Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharane Nirvasesis Nivadi Paskachade Sitarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sagana Raghunatham Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. January 3rd, 2012, Skype class, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 14, The Disappearance of Lord Krishna, Texts 32 to 33. Tadaivanu Charashore. Shruta Devo Dvaya Shruta Devo Dvaadhyaya Sunanda Nanda Shirshanya Ye Chanye Shatvashashabda Api swasyasate sarve Ramakrishna bhujashraya Api smaranti kushalam Asmakam bhara sorida Tata Eva. Similarly, Anucharaha, constant companions, Shorehe, of Lord Sri Krishna, such as Shrutadeva. Shrutadeva, Uddhava Adayaha, Uddhava and others, Sunanda, Sunanda, Nanda, Nanda, Shirshanyaha, other leaders. Yea, all of them. Cha, and Anye, others. Satvata, liberated souls. Rishabaha, the best men. Api, if. Swasti, doing well. Asate, are. Sarve, all of them. Rama, Balarama, Krishna, Lord Krishna, Bhuja Ashrayaha, under the protection of, Api, if also, Smaranti, do remember, Kushalam, welfare, Asmakam, about ourselves, Badasorudaha, bound by eternal friendship. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. This again is Maharaj Yudhisthira speaking to Bhima. Also, Shrutadev, Uddhava, and others. Oh, my computer is frozen. Also, Shrutadev, Uddhava, and others, Nanda, Sunanda, and other leaders of liberated souls who are constant companions of the Lord, are protected by Lord Balaram and Krishna. Are they all doing well in their respective functions? Do they, who are all eternally bound in friendship with us, remember our welfare? Okay, just 1 second. My computer is frozen. Let me get a book. Second. Okay, purport. The constant companions of Lord Krishna, such as Uddhava, are all liberated souls, and they descended along with Lord Krishna to this material world to fulfill the mission of the Lord. The Pandavas are also liberated souls who descended along with Lord Krishna to serve him in his transcendental pastimes on this earth. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita 4.8, the Lord and his eternal associates, who are also liberated souls like the Lord, come down on this earth at certain intervals. The Lord remembers them all, but his associates, although liberated souls, forget due to their being Tatastha Shakti, or marginal potency of the Lord. That is the difference between the Vishnu Tattva and Jiva Tattva. The jiva-tattvas are infinitesimal potential particles of the Lord, and therefore they require the protection of the Lord at all times. And to the eternal servitors of the Lord is pleased to give all protection at all times. The liberated souls never, therefore, think themselves as free as the Lord or as powerful as the Lord, but they always seek the protection of the Lord in all circumstances, both in the material world and in the spiritual world. This dependence of the liberated soul is constitutional, for the liberated souls are like sparks of a fire that are able to exhibit the glow of fire along with the fire, and not independently. Independently, the glow of the sparks is extinguished, although the quality of fire or the glowing is there. Thus, those who give up the protection of the Lord and become so-called lords themselves
out of spiritual ignorance, come back again to this material world, even after prolonged tapasya of the severest type. That is the verdict of all Vedic literatures. Tadai vanu chara shore shruta devo dadha vadaha sunanda nanda shirshanya ye chanye shat vatar shabaha api swasti asate sarve ramakrishna bujashrayaha api smaranti kushalam asma kambadaso radaha. Also, Shrutadev, Uddhava, and others, Nanda, Sunanda, and other leaders of liberated souls, who are constant companions of the Lord, are protected by Lord Balaram and Krishna. Are they all doing well in their respective functions? Do they, who are all eternally bound in friendship with us, remember our welfare? So, here we have the word Buja Ashrayaha, which Prabhupada translates as under the protection of. Under the protection of. So it's interesting because the word Buja means arms and Ashraya means shelter. So under the shelter or protection of Krishna's arms, under Krishna's shelter. And Prabhupada is making the point here that even the eternally liberated souls are under the protection of Krishna's shelter, that they don't exist separately from that. And he compares this to like the sparks of a fire. He says the sparks of a fire are able to exhibit the glow of fire along with the fire and not independently. And he says, furthermore, that this is constitutional. He said, this nature, this dependence of the liberated soul is constitutional. So that's interesting, because liberated means free. And normally freedom, we think of, means that you have no dependence at all. But here Prabhupada's saying that there's a kind of dependence that exists even in liberation. We can have some idea of that from another part of this verse. Bada sorudaha. Bada means bondage. Soruda means very deep friendship. Rida means heart. So means wonderful. So we're very dear, very close, very auspicious. So that which is auspicious to the heart is also binding. This reminds us of Madhava Mahotsava by, I believe, Jiva Goswami, which is a story of when Srimati Radharani is crowned as the queen of Vrindavan. So at the end of the ceremony, she says, let all bound persons become liberated. And at that point, her friends become very worried because they're bound to Radharani in love. And they didn't want to be liberated from that love. They wanted to remain bound in love. So this constitutional dependence of the free soul upon the Lord is also due to love. It's not like being dependent on somebody materially. I was just reading where Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati said that if you're not an invalid, but you're dependent on someone else to maintain you, that you're going to be bound in the cycle of birth and death. So it's not that kind of thing, you know, where you're living on the mercy of others. But it's a relationship, it's a natural relationship of love, just like for the young child to be dependent on the parents, or at least in traditional societies, for the wife to be dependent on the husband. So that's not something that was artificial. It was not something that was, how would you say, it was not something that was painful, but it was something that was coming from love and affection as a very natural kind of relationship. So Prabhupada's talking here about protection. He's using this ashraya, shelter, which he's translating as protection. I mean, we think about the sort of shelters that we have. Of course, we have a shelter in terms of a building. Just like where I am right now in Belgium, it's very windy and very rainy. And if you go outside, the wind is whipping your clothes around, and no matter how carefully you're dressed, you're going to get wet in such extremely windy and rainy weather. It's also kind of cold. So when we're in a building, then we're hardly aware of the wind and the rain. I mean, you can hear the wind outside, and sometimes some of it seeps through the window, but it's almost inconsequential, and you have a heater on inside, and so you have a shelter. You're sheltered from the elements. You're also sheltered from the insects. You're sheltered from wild animals, which, of course, we don't have so many of in modern society. You're sheltered from thieves. So that we think of as our house as our main shelter or protection. Then, of course, we have clothes to shelter us from immodesty, to shelter us, again, from the weather, from climate, from incense. We have our money as a kind of shelter. So most of us have some sort of savings of money. Most of us are not living just, as they say, hand to mouth. But we keep some stock of money as a sort of shelter, as a sort of protection. So if some emergency happens, that we can pay for it. We have our friends as a kind of shelter, our friends and our family, that we feel, well, if anything happens to me, I have my wife or my husband or my children or my aunts and uncle. I had one woman I was talking to, she left her family to move into the temple, and her guru made an arrangement with the temple president that because she's already in her 50s, that when she gets older, that the temple will take care of her. And she said, I haven't put it in writing. Do you think I should put it in writing? And I said, yes, definitely. But that's the idea. You know, I have some people in my life, and these people in my life, they're going to be my shelter. They're going to take care of me. Also, whatever kind of skills we have or our source of income, not only to save money, but okay, I've got a regular source of money coming in, and that's going to be my shelter. Sometimes people think of their government as their shelter. You know, the government's going to give me money in my old age, and the government is going to pay for my medical expenses and so forth. The government is going to protect me against criminals. So one may think like that. One may also think of one's abilities as one's shelter. That's very much related to one source of income, that one may think, okay, well, you know, I've always got what I know or what I can do, and that will help maintain me. So in this way, one will have all of these shelters. But, of course, we can examine very easily that all of these shelters are called by the Bhagavatam fallible soldiers. And just a little thought will immediately reveal that none of these shelters actually can be guaranteed to give us protection from what they purport to protect us from. So, of course, your house can be blown down by the wind or a fire, but even if it's still standing, you know, thieves may come into your house or insects may come into your house. Even if you keep all those things out, you can still suffer in your house. You know, the house doesn't really protect you from suffering. The clothes and the money and the friends and the society, you know, one can find suffering in the middle of all of that. One can be in the midst of friends with plenty of money in a sturdy house that's surrounded by guards, and still the miseries of life will come in, and ultimately death will come in. There's that famous story of Edgar Allan Poe, the House of the Red Death, I think it's called, can't remember. It was about a time when there was a plague, and so these people were having a party trying to keep out the Red Death, the plague of the Red Death. There was a costume party. And the Red Death came into the party. It seemed to be one of the revelers, but it was actually the death itself. And it killed everybody in their party, even though they had so many walls up. So this is the actual situation, that our destiny is going to find us, just like it says that the calf finds the mother cow in the midst of thousands of cows. It's like that with all the species. You know, the penguins, they come back from hunting and they can immediately pick out who was their baby. The babies pick out the parents pick out the baby. So whatever our karma is, whatever our destiny is, That's going to find us despite all of our shelters. Prabhupada said you cannot improve destiny by collective living. So just because we live together doesn't mean we can prevent anybody from having their destiny. And nobody can prevent us from having our destiny. So these are all fallible soldiers. We can't even protect ourselves. You know, I've not been able to protect myself from misery, although I have tried with great endeavor. What to speak of being able to protect anybody else? So rather one should come under the shelter, under the arms of Krishna and Balaram. Such a nice, the Sanskrit here is so nice. Rama Krishna Bhujashrayaha. Balaram and Krishna, the shelter of their arms. Of course, the word for Balaram is often used Rama. So what shelter is that? That's the shelter of Rama, of pleasure, and of Krishna, attraction. One should come under the shelter of the arms of the pleasure and attraction of the Supreme Lord. So of course, Krishna with his arms, he's holding up, with his just little pinky of one of his arms, he's holding up Govardhan Hill. With his arms, he's supplying an unlimited sari for Draupadi. With his arms, he's smashing the whirlwind Trinavarta. With his arms, he destroyed the demon Vyomasura and removed the rocks from the cave to save his cowherd boy. So we can think of so many ways in which the arms of Krishna and Balaram, with Balaram's arm, he's throwing Deinakasura up into the tree. I mean, I'm sure we could go on at reciting the many, many pastimes of the Lord, where through his arms, he's giving shelter and protection to his devotees. So what's the value of having Krishna's protection? What benefits do we get from having Krishna's protection? And how do we get Krishna's protection? So the benefits of Krishna's protection, well, first of all, we have actual security. It's a real shelter. Krishna's eternal. You know, I'm eternal and Krishna's eternal. And he's achutya. He never falls down. He never fails. He's not a fallible soldier. He's infallible. So one has actual security, not like the money you get at the bank that are called securities. But it's genuine. There's no, you know, the story of, what is it, the three little pigs and the wolf, and I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house down. You know, there's nobody that can blow down the house that Krishna, that's there of Krishna's arms. Nobody can defeat Krishna's arms. You know, even if apparently so, like here in Yaksha, he knocks the club out of Varaha's hand for a moment. But again, at the end, Varaha ends up defeating him. So it's real security. And therefore it's real peace. You know, it's complete peace. I know my shelter will always be there. It can never be harmed. And then one can have actual adventures. It's not just peace in the sense of boringness. Okay, now I'm just peacefully secure. Because nobody wants just peace. People also want some sort of challenge and some sort of risk. But it's risk from the platform of safety. You know, just like people go climbing a mountain with a rope. So risk and safety. So one has adventure. Krishna says that he is adventure. Krishna has so many adventures. But we know that Krishna will always emerge the hero. Wherever there is Krishna, wherever there is Arjuna, there will certainly be extraordinary power, victory, and morality. So there will always be victory, along with the adventure. And then there will be freedom. You know, generally in this world, you have to choose between security and freedom. It's kind of hard to have both. You know, what makes us so-called secure in this world is all binding. If you have your home that keeps you secure, well, you've got to pay for your home. You've got to maintain your home. You know, and then you're bound to the home. You're serving the home. If you've got family to take care of you, well, you've got to take care of your family. You've got to serve your family. And you can't be free. And as soon as you're free, then you lose your shelters. If you say, okay, I'm not going to have any family, I'm not going to have any community, I'm not going to have any income, I'm not going to have any home, then where's your security? But with Krishna, you have both security and freedom. And that's what's, you know, this very interesting statement here the Prabhupada makes. This dependence of the liberated soul is constitutional. You know, there's that famous purport where Prabhupada says that the need of the soul is to get complete freedom. That's actually the need of the soul. And of course, the word for freedom is liberation. So we can talk about, you know, freedom, but then dependence? How is that? But you do have actual freedom, because when you're dependent on the Lord, basically you can do whatever you like. Kalpaviksha lakshabhateshu. Krishna has these kalpaviksha trees that give the devotees whatever they want. You know, there's no difficulty for the devotees. What desire is it? Right? Nitya nityanam, chaitanas chaitananam, eko bhamanam yo vidadati kaman. I mean, what is it that Krishna doesn't fulfill for the devotees? They can go wherever they want. They can have whatever they want. So that's what happens when you're dependent on Krishna. Why? Because that dependence is a dependence of love. Therefore, you actually have a relationship. You know, as we're saying, as it also says here, the bada soda, the binding of love. So that kind of dependence, and Prabhupada talks about that a lot, the dependence of the child on the mother or the wife on the husband. That it's a burden of love for the protector, and it's a dependence of love for the protected. It's a very sweet thing to feel that somebody is taking care of you. And even the most independent persons, also they have this. Everybody has to have some kind of shelter. Nobody can exist with no shelter at all. At least people are taking shelter, as we say, of their abilities. So this is a very sweet, loving relationship. It's not a situation where one is feeling, oh, you know, I'm paralyzed and I can't take care of myself, and therefore someone else has to take care of me. You know, materially, it's horrible. Materially, if I'm sick or I'm injured and I'm dependent on somebody else to take care of me because I can't take care of myself, it's a horrible situation. Nobody wants to be in that kind of a situation. Little babies who are dependent, they're so eager to become mobile and to become capable. And teenagers, they're anxious to get out of the house and take care of themselves. But this dependence on the Lord is a very different thing. It's a dependence in freedom. So what happens if we don't take Krishna's protection? Well, then the opposite. You know, we're constantly in fear, because we can't be without a shelter. As Prabhupada says here in this purport, we're tatastha shakti, we're marginal. So we have to have some shelter somewhere. So either we have the real shelter or we have an illusory shelter. And we all know, everybody knows, the greatest materialist and atheist knows that the shelters they have in this world are illusory. That you can't count on your house, you can't count on your clothes, you can't count on your bank account, you can't count on your source of income, you can't count on your intelligence or your abilities, you can't count on your family, you can't count on your government. I mean, you can't even count on your own body. Our ultimate shelter in this world is our body. And therefore, we're always in fear. How are these things going to fail me? When are they going to fail me? What will I do if they fail me? I'm making all kinds of contingency plans. So much anxiety. Well, let's see, you know, if my husband leaves me, at least I've got my college degree. I mean, I hear this from women. Oh, I'm going to get my college degree, so if my husband dies or leaves me, I can still maintain myself. And, well, if this happens, I've got this backup plan. And this happens, I've got this backup plan. And, you know, if the government fails, well, I've got some gold jewelry. You know, and all these anxieties, always making plans all the time. What if this happens? And then, you know, you can't plan for every possible contingency. Like we say, you know, the miseries are going to creep under the door anyway. So much fear, anxiety, and worrying and plan making. And then so much disappointment and frustration and anger when our plans don't work out. You know, when we build this beautiful house and we find out the pipes are leaking and the walls are falling apart. Or, you know, you marry someone and then you find out that they're secretly having an affair with somebody, or they're addicted to some kind of intoxicant, or they're just not a very nice person. I mean, how many letters and discussions do I have with people? Oh, I thought this was a nice person, and after I married them, I found out they had this problem and that problem. Or, you know, I thought this was a nice house in a good neighborhood, and I found out the house had so many problems. Or, you know, I thought I was going to get a good job, and it turns out my boss is a fool, and on and on and on. So much disappointment. And then so much frustration. And I'll do it this way, that way. And then so much anger, and anger at ourselves for making foolish decisions, anger at other people for not being what we thought they were, and so many things. So as soon as we have these false shelters, we're full of fear, anxiety, plan-making, disappointment, frustration, and anger. And if we actually have Krishna as our protector, if we're under the shelter of Krishna's arms, then we have security, freedom, a loving relationship, peace, and safe adventures. So how do we get under the shelter of Krishna's arms? You know, actually, we're already under the shelter of Krishna's arms. It's not possible. You know, Prabhupada also talked about how Krishna's holding all the planets in his hands. The same idea of the arms or the hands. He said, just like you hold some dust in your hand, if you let go, it's scattered. Or that was that gospel song, you know, he's got the whole world in his hands. So we're already in Krishna's hands. It's really a question of our consciousness. But it's not only consciousness. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that seeing Krishna as your protector is manifest in body, mind, and words. So let's look at first at the mind, psychological. So one is thinking, I have no protector other than Krishna. That my so-called protectors, you know, which we've listed several times, my physical shelter made of bricks or wood, my clothing, my family and friends, my community, my government, on and on and on and on, that those things are not what's actually protecting me. It's Krishna who's protecting me. I forgot that verse. Anyway, it's in the sixth canto. That everything is actually Krishna's energy. So even if it appears that my husband is protecting me or my father is protecting me, that really it's only Krishna who's protecting me. And I don't go for psychological shelter to anyone other than Krishna. And Prabhupada writes also that it's strong faith that Krishna will save us in any dangerous condition. That Krishna will definitely protect me. But it's a mood also that Krishna, you can kill me or you can save me. Marabhi Rakabhi, Sampare Vipare. That Krishna, you're always taking care of me. You're always protecting me. But that protection can be how you want. You know, from a material point of view, it may not look like protection. Because we're all going to leave this body. So I'm accepting that whatever comes to me is actually a form of your protection. And one has this mood of a servant. Prabhupada talks about the animal that's being taken care of or the child that's being taken care of. We have that surrendered mood. Just like in the modern Western society, so many people have a dog. So the dog has a mood that I'm going to be taken care of. The dog is thinking, you know, my master is going to take care of me. That somehow or other, you know, it's going to be there. The dog isn't worried. They know that I'm going to get food, I'm going to get a bed, even my master's going to take me out for some exercise, and so forth and so on. And I mean, the loyalty of the dog is such. There are many, many stories that even after the master dies, the dog is coming every day and sitting on the grave of the master, expecting to be taken care of. So this sort of sold out surrender. Krishna is going to protect me. And feeling a sense of trust. Feeling trust, feeling security, and thinking Krishna is going to take care of me. So on the level of emotions, feeling trust, feeling security, feeling faith, and on the level of thought, saying no matter what happens, Krishna will always protect me. And however he chooses to protect me, whether that's an apparent external protection or even if I die, or something apparently bad happens to me, I have full trust that whatever Krishna does is for the best. And then what about in words? You know, the devotee is always speaking like that. That's one of the things you noticed if you spend time around non-devotees. The way they talk about things is very different. So the devotee will always say, well, it's up to Krishna, Krishna willing. And I know Krishna is going to take care of me. And I know Krishna is going to be my protector. So the devotee is always speaking like that, both internal speaking in the mind and external speaking. And then behavior is very interesting. People often ask, well, how does a person confident of Krishna's protection behave? One letter Prabhupada wrote to Karandar was, if one is very cautious, then Krishna will give him protection. Prabhupada said, do not be callous, be cautious. So it's not that the devotee who feels Krishna's protection is going to do something foolish, because that's not the behavior of a servant. You know, I know if I work for a company and I'm a loyal worker for that company will protect me. But as part of being a loyal worker for the company, I have to be very cautious about my activities. So this is reasonable. It's part of taking shelter of Krishna, is that I try to do things carefully. That means that I try to eat things that are going to be healthy for my body. And I look both ways before I cross the street, and I put on a seat belt, and so forth and so on. But ultimately, I know that there's no precautions I can take that are going to keep me safe. Now, also, how you depend on Krishna's protection depends a lot on your varna and your ashram. It depends on what service you're doing. Just like a little earlier in the Bhagavatam, in Canto 1, Chapter 11, Text 23, where it's described that the old and invalid brahmanas were coming to Krishna when he returned to Dwarka, and they were praising the king. And Prabhupada writes in that purport that the brahmanas didn't stock anything for their old age. He said they didn't bank anything for their old age. They figured when they were old and invalid, they could come and tell the king his histories. The king would feel enlivened and naturally take care of them. So the sannyasi is supposed to just travel the world. The traditional sannyasi was traveling barefoot through the jungles. Like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was traveling in South India. He had four sets of clothes, you know, a little bag with his clothes. He had his, you know, fingers for chanting on. And he had his, one or two servants who would come with him and take care of collecting some food. But they didn't make any prior arrangements. And we see this with a lot of the padyatras, where they just take a bullock cart and they're going from one city to the next, and they don't make any prior arrangements. Wherever they get to that city, they simply have kirtan, and people will put them up. So that's really the mood of the sannyasi. Just whatever, you know, it's fearlessness. That is the primary feature of sannyas life. Prabhupada says, without being fearless, one should not take to sannyas life. So the mood of Krishna as my protector is manifest by the sannyasi in traveling like that. But that doesn't mean that the grihastha cannot also fully have the mood of Krishna as my protector, but the service is different. The grihastha has to apparently act as if they're the protector. You know, the grihastha has to build a house or buy a house and bank some money and have some source of income and so many things. Keep some stock of grains. Of course, sometimes Prabhupada said the Brahmin householder who's dependent on charity doesn't do those things. But generally speaking, the householder is doing those things. I mean, even the brahmachari who's living in the ashrama, that's much more of an external protected situation than the sannyasi or the vanaprastha. You know, the vanaprastha is supposed to live out in the forest, keeping a shelter only to protect the sacred fire and exposing themselves to the elements. So, of course, I don't think any of us are living that kind of, at least I haven't met anybody who's living that kind of vanaprastha or sannyas life. But the point is that exactly how we manifest that Krishna is our protector, that's going to depend on our individual situation and our individual service. You know, on one level, you can say that it's easier to realize Krishna is your protector when you're out on traveling Sankirtan or on Padyatra, and you don't have, you know, any or almost any of the external illusions of the fallible soldiers being infallible that someone has in another life. But it's entirely possible to live an external life as a renunciate and still have a mentality of anxiety and simply be trying to set everything up, you know, and have all the fallible soldiers in place. And on the other hand, it's possible to be in the grihastha ashram and be a vaishya or kshatriya who are earning a lot of money and who are living in very opulent situations, you know, with bodyguards and armies and so many things, and still completely have the mood, like Maharaj Yudhisthira has. I mean, Maharaj Yudhisthira, if we look at this verse, who is he talking about? Shudadev, Uddhava, Nanda, Sunanda, you know, these were kshatriyas. These were people who had armies and great palaces, and yet their mood was Ramakrishna Bhujashrayaha, that under the protective arms of Balaram and Krishna. That was their mentality. So being under Krishna's protection isn't dependent on our external circumstances, but we will manifest that protection, that we will manifest our mood of being under Krishna's protection differently according to our different external situations. Of course, it's not that the externals have nothing to do with it. You know, I was really meditating lately on how Srila Prabhupada will talk in his purports about having a naturally opulent society, making it much easier for persons to be God-conscious, and having a society of factories and slaughterhouses, making it much more difficult to be God-conscious. And in this respect, I was reading, it's very old research, I'm sure you're all very familiar with this, what they call the broken window theory, where they say if you go someplace and there's one broken window, that you're much more likely to commit a crime than you would in a place where there's no broken windows. And for example, there was in the 1980s and early 90s, there were a lot of crimes in the New York subways. And then the New York City appointed a new head of the police department or whatever. And what he decided to do was get all the graffiti off the subway cars, and also to arrest anybody who was jumping over the turnstiles without paying. So both of those were considered very petty crimes, you know, getting on the subway train without paying and drawing graffiti on the cars. But just by taking care of those two things, there was an immediate huge drop in serious crimes like armed robbery on the subways. So just a small adjustment in the external circumstances made a huge adjustment in people's behavior and in people's mentality. So it is a fact that although in one sense our mentality of being under Krishna's protection is not dependent on our varna or ashram or on our external circumstances, on the other hand, we may be able to make very small adjustments in our external situation that makes a huge difference in our consciousness of that Krishna is the protector. And I think that these sort of adjustments are things that people have to decide on an individual basis. And one way we can decide that is we can look at, well, what are my fallible soldiers? I mean, we listed earlier fallible soldiers that people tend to have in common, you know, a building and clothing and whatever talents and abilities and knowledge I have that brings in my income, the savings I have in the bank, my family, my society, friendship and love, and so forth and so on. But for each of us, some of these fallible soldiers tend to be more prominent than others. So some people are much more psychologically dependent on their family members as a source of shelter, some on their friendship connections, some on their bodily health and bodily strength, some on the money they have, and so forth. So we can examine, you know, do I have some fallible soldier in my life that's really making it difficult for me to see that Krishna is my protector? And is there some, you know, adjustment I can make in my life so that I'm much more likely to see Krishna rather than that fallible soldier? And devotees have done this, you know, in different ways, changed how they make their living or changed the nature of their dealings with their family members or made some small adjustment in the externals. And of course, we can make the adjustment in the internals, that when we catch ourselves feeling in anxiety, especially when we catch ourselves in disappointment, frustration, and anger, then we can stop and say, okay, what wrong shelter did I have? I mean, it's just really quite interesting. Generally, when we're frustrated, disappointed, and angry, we're focusing it externally. But if we can also kind of reflect it back and say, if I'm feeling frustrated, angry, and disappointed, it means that I probably was leaning on a fallible soldier that collapsed under me. And the point is that I wasn't leaning in the right place. I wasn't under the shelter of the right arms. And this way we can adjust our internal consciousness. We can also do that by how we speak, like Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, that being under Krishna's protection is body, mind, and words. You know, what do I talk about? It's really interesting. You notice even devotees. There are some devotees who will talk constantly about what's going on in the government and politics, what's going on with this war and that politician and this economic policy and this, you know. Some devotees will talk a lot about the weather, or they'll talk a lot about their clothing, or they talk a lot about their family. I mean, notice, what do we talk about? What's absorbing our attention? Some people will talk a lot about this or that problems, you know, in ISKCON or whatever spiritual society they're a member of. And whatever is absorbing our attention is probably our shelter, because that's what we're worrying about. That's what we're concerned about. That's what we're trying to control. That's what we're trying to make plans for. So one can change one's talking to talk more about Krishna, to add language into our everyday conversations about how Krishna is our protector. You know, to stop ourselves when we find ourselves being absorbed in family, society, government, work, and say, let me become absorbed in Krishna and how Krishna protects his devotees. And then if we do that, then we'll be bound by these deep, loving friendships, and we'll find the freedom and the security and the happiness that we want. And we shouldn't think that this is a highly advanced stage. I was just reading in Jiva Dharma where Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about the six symptoms of surrender, one of which is seeing Krishna as the protector, as a precursor to taking up the process of sadhana bhakti. So in one sense, surrender is by degrees, and full surrender and full trust is only going to be there at prema. But in another very real sense, there's a kind of meaningful and deep and satisfying surrender that can happen at the very beginning. And in the name of honesty, we don't have to say, well, I can't surrender to Krishna now, I'm not advanced enough. Perhaps we're equating surrender to Krishna to living barefoot through the forest without any prior plans for how we're going to eat that day. Now, that might not be the right external manifestation of surrender for our particular service or varna and ashrama. But the mood of total surrender, the mood of thinking Krishna is my protector, that can be there for anybody immediately. That's not something that one has to undergo some tremendous amount of purification in order to do. Because frankly, it's already there. It's really a question of acknowledging the reality. It's not really much more than that. There's not a whole lot that one has to do rather than see things as they are and acknowledge them and rejoice in what they are. That really the only one who's ever been protecting me is Krishna. No one else has ever been protecting me. It's only his arms I've ever been under. And let's just see how in so many ways he's protected me over and over and over again. And let me just acknowledge that. And then one achieves everything that one wants. Okay, so questions, comments, additions, subtractions.
I'll make a comment. I'll make two comments, a serious comment and a frivolous comment. Serious comment. You were talking earlier about, well, actually, your whole class, about taking shelter, especially in the beginning, Mother, when you were talking so much about taking shelter of fallible soldiers. And I was all through that section thinking, and the verse that Prabhupada quotes so much, yasya ham nugrahami haratye tadanam shunai tatodanam chijanjas yasvajana dukaduvitam. He especially was quoted in this verse when he was talking about how his before he took sannyas, his business was starting to have problems. He was starting to have family problems. So in that verse, it's described that Krishna's greatest stroke of mercy is when he takes things away, when he smashes, when he flushes us out of our fallible soldiers. And in that way, almost helps us to become free from them so that we can fully take shelter of him. And that's that great blessing, Hari, one who takes away. Frivolous comment. You make it hard to ask questions. It seems like every time I write down a nice question, especially at the beginning of class, or several questions, by the time the second half of the class, I'm scratching off one at a time my questions because you answer them. You get us really thinking, and I come up with a good question. I had a whole list of them, and by the time you get to the end of the class, they're all scratched off. So thank you for a wonderful class.
All right, Krishna. But when you were talking about Krishna smashing the false shelters, you could just think of it, suppose a friend of yours is out in the rain, and they're under an umbrella with holes in it. You know, you might want to pull it out of their hand and give them a good umbrella.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Anybody else?
Well, Brother Erdogan, when I'm dealing with class, I always feel stretched. This might sound like I wasn't listening, but I really was, but I just don't quite understand. Anything in this world is a fallible soldier if we're taking shelter of it. So if you have money in the bank or you have relationships with others that you're dependent on for upliftment, you know, that are not exactly Christian, you know, whatever, like you were talking, well, then what you need to do is to eradicate those. But then you also mentioned it depends individually on what stage of life you're in, what barn and ashram you're in, for what that's going to be. So I'm just confused as far as where do you call the line? Especially that was scary when you were saying, like, for instance, Brahmanas, they don't bank anything. They don't plan on the future. They don't have any kind of resources. They just depend on the king. My goodness, where's the king?
First of all, that's Brahmin householders who live on charity. So not all Brahmin householders live directly on charity. That's the austerity. If you're a householder that lives on charity, because generally charity is given to the renunciates. Generally charity is given to the brahmacharis who have to focus on study, and that's how the schools are maintained. Or given to the sannyasis and vanaprastas because they've given up their source of livelihood. So generally, the grihasthas are not supposed to live on charity. The brahmana grihasthas are allowed to live on charity, but if they do so, then the austerity that they have to do in order to qualify living on charity is that they don't bank anything. You don't want, even in materialistic society, nobody likes a person who lives on charity and is rich. It's very unpalatable. So that's the price. If you want to live on charity, then you can't stock anything. You have to be willing to live on whatever you get. But the practical reality is that there is no backup. You know, what we do in life is we say, okay, you know, I'm going to beg from the king. Maybe the king won't give me anything. Okay, I'll have this backup plan. And if my wife's not nice to me, then I've got some books I can read as my backup plan. Or I have a friend I can call. You know, we have all these. We're backing up one fallible soldier with another fallible soldier. The thing is not to get rid of the relationships and not to get rid of the money. I mean, that can be done in sannyas life. But that's not the point. The point is getting rid of the mentality that I'm protecting anybody else or that anybody else is protecting me. That's the point. And now how that externally manifests, you know, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was still doing his job and maintaining his family, but his mood was, Krishna's maintaining my family and Krishna's given me this service to do.
Just like Arjuna, you know, Arjuna knew that Krishna was killing everybody on the battlefield, but that was the service that he was supposed to do. Prabhupada said Krishna didn't give Arjuna some kind of magic powder. Okay, you just sleep on the chariot when I'll kill everybody. Arjuna actually had to fight. And in a similar way, one may have to go out and earn a living. One may have to cook the meals for the family and make sure that the children's clothes are washed. And, you know, but that's a service. It's no longer that I'm doing this as a means of protecting myself or protecting others or seeking protection. I'm doing it as a service, and Krishna's taking care of me. I'm not worried. I was just listening to one devotee here at the college who was telling me something very interesting. He was telling me how one of the devotees here had a responsibility of getting some books for the courses in the summertime, and at that time the college had no money. So the book person was saying, well, how can I order the books if there's no money? And this other devotee said, that's not your problem. We'll take care of that. You just order the books. And the book person kept saying, but how will you do it? And the other devotee said, well, look, I can put it on my own credit card, and I know when the money comes in later, then I'll get paid back. But anyway, that's not your business. You don't need to worry about that. I'm telling you just to order the books, and we'll take care of the money. And the person in charge of the books kept insisting and insisting until there was an argument. So I think it's something like that. You know, we have our duty to do. And how exactly we're going to be protected and when we're going to be protected is not really our concern. It's something like when you're a child. You know, you have a business of going to school and doing your studies. And, you know, how the bills are paid is not really, that's not your business. It's Krishna's business. It's your parents' business. You know, and as devotees, we do our duty. And my duty may involve taking care of money. And my duty may involve being kind to my wife, and my duty may involve, I was just reading what Prabhupada said, the householders should be kind to all the animals around their house with affection, just like they are to their own children. So the implication there is that it's part of the duty of a man to have affection for his children. But if the man's thinking, I'm protecting my children, I'm protecting my wife, that's nonsense. Or if the man's thinking, you know, my wife and children will protect me, I'm doing this for Krishna. I'm not doing it for some fruit in this world. It's just a free exchange of love. And whether that manifests as actually taking care of a wife or whether it manifests as going through the forest is not really the point. That's, in one sense, that's almost irrelevant. Is that clear?
Well, thank you very much. I really like how you use simple examples to get a handle on. I'm glad I asked. Thank you for the answer, Dan. Very, very good.
I had a question.
Go ahead.
Yes.
What should we as devotees do when we see other devotees, you know, having some difficulty doing their material responsibilities, well, use the excuse, well, I'm just depending on Krishna, without finding fault?
Well, it depends what our service is. So if the person who's having that problem is our child, our student, our disciple, if it's somebody we're supposed to guide, then it's our responsibility to guide that person. And say, you know, like Prabhupada talked about Arjuna. He said Arjuna was avoiding his duty in the name of Krishna consciousness. He was using Krishna consciousness as an excuse to avoid being Krishna conscious. And Krishna didn't even tell him that until Arjuna surrendered and became a disciple. And if somebody's not in our sphere of people we're supposed to guide, then we leave it. It's not our business. And we can always think about the many ways in which we're deficient and the many ways in which we misuse our spiritual life and misuse our relationship with Krishna and work on ourselves. But for most of us have some people in our life that we have some responsibility for and we're guiding. I haven't met too many people who are only responsible for themselves. But that we have to look at. Otherwise, our interference in the other person's life
we'll be going beyond the bounds of our service, and then we're not really a servant. And it won't benefit either ourselves and them. I mean, having said that, there are sometimes emergencies where we have to go beyond the bounds of our normal service, but that's something unusual. This is, we were just reading about this here in Belgium, about the story of Bharat Maharaj, and why was his care of the deer so entangling for him, and whereas, say, Shivananda Sain's care of the dog was not entangling for him. And one of the answers was that he was going out of the bounds of his service, that previously he'd been the king, he was supposed to take care of all the living entities, but now as a renunciate in the forest, he was not meant to show that degree of affection and care for a deer. It was beyond the bounds of what he was supposed to do. So this knowing, I remember I went once to Burjampu with a question. I said, you know, this, I'm really concerned about this, it's really bothering me, what should I do about it? And Burjampu looked at me and said, first question to ask is this your service? So when it comes to other people, that's a particularly important question. That, you know, is it my service? Is it my service, A, to even be judging this person? Is it my service to even be examining them at all and seeing to what extent they're negligent in the name of renunciation? And to what extent is it my service to guide them? And I can tell whether or not it's my service by several things. First of all, what's my external relationship? Is this person my student, my child, my disciple? Are they my subordinate in service? You know, am I running the restaurant and they work in the restaurant? I mean, do I have some position of authority over them? That's the first question. Next question to ask is, what kind of actual relationship do I have with them? Because even if someone's technically my student, if they don't they're not really submissive to what I say, then my responsibility over them is much less. So I had somebody recently like that. They were asking my advice, and then they kept arguing with me. And I finally said to them, you know, I don't think I can help you, because on the one hand, you're asking me advice, and on the other hand, you're telling me that you know better than me. So, you know, figure it out yourself. So it may be like that, that sometimes with our own children or our own students or whatever, you know, they're not receptive. Or they may be not receptive on Monday and maybe they're receptive on Tuesday. Or maybe they're not receptive when we say it one way and they're receptive when we say it another way. So that's also part of what is my service. That even if someone is technically under my authority, it doesn't mean I can tell them any way or any time or in any circumstances. You know, we have in the Bhagavad Gita delineation of whether things are in the modes, or often is it the right time and circumstances. Like if you give charity at the wrong time in the wrong place. You know, if you try to give somebody charity while they're taking a shower, that's in the mode of ignorance. So in the same way, if I try to give someone instruction when they're not receptive, they're sick, they're tired, they have some other anxiety. It just reminded me of the story of Lord Nityananda kicked Shivananda Sain, and Shivananda Sain's nephew, I believe it was very, Shrikant, I think his name was very upset about this. And he left the party of Shivananda Sain and went ahead to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And when he came to see Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and offered his obeisances, he kept on his upper garment, which in those days in Bengal was not proper. When you go to see a superior person or the deity, for the man, you're not wearing an upper garment. And one devotee was disturbed at this. And Mahaprabhu said, oh, just leave him alone. His mind is disturbed. And therefore, you know, you don't take this as some sort of disrespect. And then Shrikant was so amazed that Mahaprabhu knew that his mind was disturbed that he didn't end up bringing his complaint to the Lord. The point is, if a person is very disturbed, they may not be able to hear what you have to say. I recently ran into one devotee in Mayapur who had come to me asking for advice about a personal situation many years ago. And when I tried to give her advice, she wasn't able to hear it. And finally, I just said, well, just chant Hare Krishna. And when I just saw her recently in Mayapur, she was so happy. And she said, oh, Urmila, I was finally able to understand what you were trying to tell me. She said, I couldn't hear it at the time. I said, I know you couldn't hear it. And so I finally just went to something else. So, you know, what's my technical relationship with that person? Despite the technical relationship, are they actually open to hearing from me?
And if they're open to hearing from me, is there a particular circumstance in which they'd be more likely to hear from me? And is there a certain way of presenting it where they'd be more likely to hear from me? And the final caveat is make sure you're right. Because there's plenty of times when I thought that somebody was doing something wrong, and I thought that I knew better than somebody, and I just didn't have all the information. Or I really didn't know what the person's mentality was. And, you know, sometimes it's really embarrassing where you go to give someone advice as if you were some big hotshot, and then you find out that actually you didn't know the whole story, and really they were the properly situated ones and you weren't. So that's a little bit of a long answer, but I hope that that's all right.
Situation, like I was talking about, as I was thinking of this as you were talking, Mataji, about how we don't want to interfere in people's lessons. Just like when we're teaching a child, or we're teaching even, you know, an adult something, and we want them to learn it. We want them to figure it out by themselves, because that's how they're going to learn it best. If we just give them the answer, then, you know, that's usually the best way for them to imbibe the solution. So may also be that.
That's a really good point, because people are much more, all of us, we're much more likely to learn something when we discover it ourselves. Now, a good teacher can help you discover it yourself without having to get, you know, thrown around by experience. Can kind of set up a simulated experience. But yeah, I mean, even if you are in that position, the best way to help somebody is to sort of gently, you know, lead them so that they discover it for themselves and go, that's what I'm doing. And you'll see that the most expert preachers are really, really good at doing that. I was just on this very topic of today's class. I was just, we won't say where we were. Anyway, I was just in a particular part of the world with one of the most expert preachers. And one of the members of the audience asked about saving money for retirement and said, you know, I'm worrying a lot. My children are growing up now and I want to save for their college and save for our old age. And, you know, my wife and I would like to retire from working and devote ourselves full time to the mission. And we're worrying, how much money do we have to save? And, you know, and are these healthy fears or unhealthy fears? He asked. So the devotee answering the question was saying, well, if they're for service, they're healthy fears. And if they're not for service, their unhealthy fears, in a very general way, and I felt a very soft way, and that was kind of the end of that. And then later in the day, it was on a Sunday, so there was a Sunday feast lecture. The same preacher was speaking, and in the course of the general discussion, made a comment that it's materialistic to be in anxiety over how I'm going to be maintained in my old age. And I thought how brilliantly it was done. It wasn't done at the time that the person asked the question. It was done a few hours later. It wasn't directed at that particular individual. It was made more as a general comment in the class. So there's ways that one may be able to get one's point across so that the person is more likely. You know, I'm also thinking about how when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, and regularly in class, I was hearing about the materialists. And after a couple months, I thought, why are they always talking about materialists? And then all of a sudden, it occurred to me that I was the materialist. But it was something that I figured out, that was revealed to me. Nobody came up to me and said, oh, by the way, Urmila, all these materialists we're talking about in class every day, that's you. And you better get it together. You know, it wasn't like that. And because it wasn't done like that, because it was something that I gradually realized, the effect was much more pronounced. And I can still remember today how I felt when that sort of dawned on me. All right, is there anything else?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.